Chapter 23. Dissension. Soon after the Senate hearings concluded in mid-March 1970, the Phoenix controversy was again obscured by a larger event. On April 30, 1970, 10 days after he had proposed withdrawing 150,000 American troops by the end of the year, Richard Nixon announced that U.S. and South Vietnamese forces had invaded Cambodia. A deviation from the Nixon doctrine, the Cambodian invasion was the culmination of 12 years of covert actions against the government of Prince Norodom Sihanouk. The final phase began on March 12, 1970, while Sihanouk was abroad, and his prime minister, Lon Nol, under instructions from the CIA, ordered all North Vietnamese out of Cambodia within 72 hours. That same day, Deputy Prime Minister Sirik Mattak canceled a trade treaty between Cambodia and the Provisional Revolutionary Government. 4 days later, the U.S. merchant ship Columbia Eagle, which was ostensibly carrying munitions for U.S. Air Force units in Thailand, was commandeered by two CIA officers, who steered it into the port of Sihanoukville. Armed with guns and ammunition from the Columbia Eagle, and backed by the Khmer Kampuchea Krom, Cambodian exiles trained by the CIA in South Vietnam, and the Khmer Serai, Cambodians under Son Nhoc Thanh, trained by the CIA in Thailand, Lon Nol's forces seized control of the government and moved against the Khmer Rouge, Cambodian communists, and the Vietnamese who supported Prince Sihanouk. The CIA had been planning the operation since August 1969, when the murder of Thai Kak Chuyen had brought about an end to Detachment B-57. The CIA plan called for the Khmer Serai to attack Khmer Rouge positions from their base in Thailand, while Lon Nol seized Phnom Penh, using deserters from Sihanouk's palace guard, backed by Khmer Kampuchea Krom, KKK, forces from South Vietnam. But the plan quickly got off track. Stanley Carnot notes, Cambodia was convulsed by anarchy in late March 1970. Rival Cambodian gangs were hacking each other to pieces, in some instances celebrating their prowess by eating the hearts and livers of their victims. Cambodian vigilantes organized by the police and other officials were murdering local Vietnamese, including women and infants. What Carnot describes is Phoenix feasting on Phnom Penh. Aided by the CIA, the Cambodian secret police fed blacklists of targeted Vietnamese to the Khmer Serai and Khmer Kampuchea Krom. The Vietnamese woman who translated the Truth About Phoenix article recalled what happened. These were not VC being killed, she said. I remember that. These were mass killings of Vietnamese merchants and Vietnamese people in Cambodia. Oh yeah, oh yeah. I remember because a friend of mine told me. He was 100% Vietnamese, but he didn't succeed in Vietnam, so when he was young, he became a Cambodian citizen and served in the Cambodian government. There were many, many Vietnamese people who went to Cambodia to settle. They were leaders of the economy and the government. But the Vietnamese were not loved by the Cambodians, like the Chinese in Vietnam, and there was a mass execution of all those Vietnamese. They cut off their heads and threw them in the river. On April 4th, the communists counterattacked, and by late April, the forces of Lon Nol were faltering. As planned, Nol asked Washington for help, and soon South Vietnamese planes were flying supplies to Phnom Penh. Hastening to support his besieged client, Nixon encouraged General Abrams to propose intervention by American combat units as well. Abrams broadened the targets to include sanctuaries in the Fishhook border region further north, where he also claimed to have located the legendary communist headquarters, COSVN. The ultimate mission of Phoenix, of course, had always been to neutralize what John Vann at the Senate hearings called the brains of the insurgency, and insofar as COSVN was the locus of the VCI, the Cambodian invasion was a massive attack against the VCI. Indeed, the Phoenix Directorate contributed directly to this last desperate attempt to win the war, primarily as a result of the personal relationship John Mason shared with his comrade from World War II, General Creighton Abrams. The bond of trust these two men enjoyed enabled them to bridge the bureaucratic abyss that often separates the CIA and the military. As important as the relationship between Mason and Abrams, however, was the relationship between Mason and Lieutenant Colonel Thomas P. McGreevy, who in July 1969 became the Directorate's operations chief, replacing Lieutenant Colonel Al Wydes. An engaging and immensely likable man, McGreevy was a graduate of West Point, where he roomed with Richard Secord, who in 1964 was sent to Joint U.S. Military Advisor Group, JUSMAG, in Bangkok as an advisor to Thai intelligence. In Bangkok, McGreevy met weekly with a MAG commander, General Richard Stilwell, with a CIA station chief, Red Jansen, and with John Mason, who was stationed in Hawaii but made frequent trips to Bangkok. In effect, McGreevy was working as the military's liaison to the CIA in Southeast Asia, establishing coordinated intelligence operations in Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam, in which capacity he visited South Vietnam at one-month intervals, was introduced to the senior special branch, MSS, and PRU officials, and became intimately aware of their operations. In 1966, McGreevy returned to the United States to become chief of the 108th Military Intelligence Group in Boston, where he supervised operations throughout New England. Then in 1967, at the request of the acting chief of staff for intelligence, General Chester Johnson, McGreevy returned to Bangkok to facilitate a trilateral agreement among the United States, Thailand, and South Vietnam. As a result of this agreement, Thai intelligence began running joint operations in Cambodia and Laos, where Secord was managing the air war for the Vientiane station chief, Ted Shackley, with the Vietnamese CIO and the CIA. In July 1969, McGreevy was assigned to be the MACV intelligence chief in Tu Corps. When John Mason learned that McGreevy had arrived in Saigon, Mason immediately arranged for him to be reassigned to the Phoenix Directorate. In turn, McGreevy had a number of his former aides in Thailand transferred to the directorate, and after a period of orientation in respect to Phoenix operations in the provinces, he and his team began utilizing their contacts in Thailand in preparation for the Cambodian invasion. McGreevy obtained information on COSVN through his sources in Thai intelligence and through the handful of penetrations the directorate had inside COSVN. These penetrations existed at several levels, but the most significant penetration was COSVN's deputy finance director, who alerted McGreevy when the finance director was going on vacation, enabling McGreevy to mount a black propaganda campaign in which he said the finance director was running off with embezzled funds. In February 1970, Lieutenant Colonel Cao Ming Tiep was transferred from his job as chief of the Combined Intelligence Center to become McGreevy's counterpart in the Fung Hwang office. At this point, General Abrams asked John Mason to intensify Phoenix operations in the border provinces in preparation for the invasion. This was done primarily through PRU teams that searched for infiltration routes and supply caches. Meanwhile, McGreevy was reading reports from the Special Operations Group, which, under Colonel Steve Cavanaugh in liaison with CIA Officer Joe Moran, was mounting its own operations against COSVN. McGreevy also read reports submitted from Special Forces A camps and from the Army Security Agency, ASA, which was attempting to locate COSVN through its radio transmissions. But the best intelligence on COSVN came from Thai units in Cambodia. To obtain this information, McGreevy and Cao Ming Tiep, in the company of a team of Vietnamese CIO officers, were flown by the CIA to Bangkok, to the military side of the airport, where they met in the security center with Colonel Sophon and Colonel Panay from Thai intelligence. Said McGreevy, "In April, we provided to General Abrams a picture of what COSVN looked like and where the key people were. On May 11, 1970, Newsweek reported that near the town of My Mo, COSVN's reinforced concrete bunkers are believed to spread 15 to 20 feet beneath the jungle surface and to house some 5,000 men. Upon arriving in My Mo, however, American troops found only a scattering of empty huts, their occupants having fled weeks before in anticipation of the assault." As Carnell quips, the drive against COSVN turned out to be quixotic. Quixotic, yes, but only in the sense that the VCI was not headquartered in a particular set of underground bunkers in My Mo. The invasion deflected attention from the CIA-engineered coup and bloodbath in Phnom Penh. It enabled Lon Nol to install a pro-American government in Cambodia, and it allowed Union Oil of California to secure concessions for all onshore and much offshore Cambodian oil. The Phoenix Directorate's participation in the Cambodian invasion, if the program is viewed as a bell curve, was certainly its climax. It was not, however, the extent of the Directorate's role in operations against the VCI. Operations Chief Tom McGreevy managed, from his office in Saigon, several actions against high-level VCI in South Vietnam. He cites as an example the time the Pleiku Province Phoenix officer got information on an impending VCI regional meeting near a tea plantation in Tukor. McGreevy asked the Army Security Agency to pinpoint the location of the meeting, and it obliged him by intercepting and tracking VCI radio communications. McGreevy then sent in a SEAL team that captured several high-ranking VCI. In conjunction with the CIA station, the Phoenix Directorate also mounted penetrations of and ran operations against high-level VCI through special teams that never appeared on any of its rosters. American soldiers assigned to this highly compartmentalized aspect of Phoenix were enlisted men trained in the United States by the CIA, then sent to Vietnam, where they were briefed by CIA, SOG, and MACV intelligence officers at the Ho Nhoc Tao Special Forces Camp on such matters as liaison procedures with the Vietnamese, the role of hunter-killer teams, how to screen detainees, district and province chief responsibilities, where input would come from, and where resources were available. Members of these special teams were given a sterile unit cover, usually as part of an Army Security Agency radio research unit, and were assigned only at corps and division level. While they were out on anti-VCI operations, their daily activity reports were falsified to show that they had been present at high-level briefings. Said McGreevy, "The teams were in place when I got there." The team in Bien Hoa, for example, was assigned for administrative purposes to the 175th Radio Research Unit, which was headquartered on the Bien Hoa military base. The team itself, however, was located in a safe house next to an old train station in Bien Hoa City. The team was composed of 10 enlisted men, divided into 5 two-man teams under the Region Phoenix Coordinator. The team's top priority was collecting tactical military intelligence in support of the Bien Hoa military base, but it also conducted currency investigations and an attack against the VCI. Regarding this latter function, the special team in Bien Hoa reported to the CIA's special unit, which included women analysts, at the embassy annex. These CIA analysts read Phoenix reports on a daily basis, assessing them for potential intelligence recruitment leads, PIRLs, then decided how a particular VCI could be approached in order to be developed as a penetration agent. Generally, VCI were told they could work for the CIA or they could appear to have been killed by their own people. The program was basically a system of identification and control within the VCI, so GVN officials could assume positions of power after the impending ceasefire. Special teams like the one in Bien Hoa operated above the Phoenix Province organization, so there were occasional accidents. For example, in one case, a VCI was removed from the blacklist and approached as a PIRL. However, the Phoenix team in the district got to him first and killed him. The Phoenix advisor was just doing his job and doing it well, but it ruined the recruitment, which had taken 3 months to develop. Another case in which the Bien Hoa special team was involved concerned a village chief who was supposedly loyal to the GVN. He was a former Viet Minh, a southern Vietnamese who had not gone north. A strong nationalist, he hated Americans, but he also saw the North Vietnamese trying to control the South, and he hated the North, too, and that was his motivation to work with the CIA. But it was a shaky motive, and when a team of NVA agents came and made him feel comfortable with their presence, he became a double agent. The chief was also the Viet Cong tax collector, in which capacity he went around the VC political officer, who gave him access to unit cadre. At that point, he was also working for the CIA, and when it gave him a polygraph test, he failed. Then, a GVN team got ambushed en route to meet him, so he was terminated with extreme prejudice, which meant, along with his entire family, in such a way that it was made to appear that he was taken out by the Viet Cong. The job was done by the Vietnamese Ranger team assigned to Bien Hoa Special Team. Other times, the Americans did the terminations themselves, making sure to kill everyone so there would be no witnesses, and using brass catchers so there would be no incriminating evidence. Other times, the special team sent in SEALs. Make no mistake about it, Americans who were involved in Phoenix suffered wounds that were not just physical. Many returned to the United States emotionally wrecked, fearful of being prosecuted for war crimes. Many began to doubt the reasons they were given for fighting the war. Back home in the United States in 1970, many people were reaching the same conclusion, although belatedly because facts about the covert operations that fueled the war were slow to emerge. For example, not until he was released from prison after the war did Tran Ngoc Chau reveal that a systematic campaign of vilification by use of forged documents was carried out during the mid-1950s to justify Diem's refusal to negotiate with Hanoi in preparation for the unheld unifying elections of 1956. According to Chau, the forging was done by U.S. and British intelligence agencies, which helped gather authentic documents that permitted plausible foundations to be laid for the forgeries. These were distributed to various political groups as well as to writers and artists who used the false documents to carry out the propaganda campaign. Forged documents used to justify and conceal illegal activities often appear in the form of captured documents, similar to the type described by Chau. As two aides to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee reported about the Cambodian invasion, there seems to be captured documents to prove any point or to support, retrospectively, almost any conclusion. When used against an individual, forged documents are called a compromise and discreditation operation. Along with recruitment in place, defection, capture, and killing, the compromise and discreditation operation was a standard procedure employed by Phoenix personnel. Its purpose was to create dissension among the VCI, to make them suspect that one of their own had betrayed them. Compromise and discreditation were accomplished by conducting whisper campaigns and by planting forged documents or incriminating evidence, usually to reflect dishonesty, immorality, or greed. Forged letters are a CIA specialty, writes former CIA officer Philip Agee. I would say our most successful operation in Ecuador was the framing of Antonio Flores Benitez, a key member of the Communist Revolutionary Movement. By bugging Flores's phone, we found out a lot of what he was doing. His wife was a blabbermouth. He made a secret trip to Havana, and we decided to do a job on him when he landed back in Ecuador. With another officer, I worked all one weekend to compose a report from Flores to the Cubans. It was a masterpiece. The report implied that Flores's group had already received funds from Cuba and was now asking for more money in order to launch guerrilla operations in Ecuador. My Quito station chief, Warren Dean, approved the report. In fact, he loved it so much he just had to get into the act. So he dropped the report on the floor and walked on it a while to make it look pocket-worn. Then he folded it and stuffed it into a toothpaste tube, from which he had spent 3 hours carefully squeezing out all the toothpaste. He was like a kid with a new toy. So then I took the tube out to the Minister of the Treasury, who gave it to his customs inspector. When Flores came through customs, the inspector pretended to go rummaging through one of his suitcases. What he really did, of course, was slip the toothpaste tube into the bag and then pretend to find it there. When he opened the tube, he, of course, discovered the report. Flores was arrested, and there was a tremendous scandal. This was one of a series of sensational events that we had a hand in during the first 6 months of 1963. By late July of that year, the climate of anti-communist fear was so great that the military seized a pretext and took over the government, jailed all the communists it could find, and outlawed the Communist Party. Likewise, according to Donald Freed in Death in Washington, the catalyst for the 1973 coup in Chile was a forged document detailing a leftist plot to start a reign of terror, which was discovered by the enemies of President Salvador Allende Gossens. The result was a violent military coup, which the CIA officers, who had set it in motion through disinformation in the press, sat back and watched from a safe distance. Compromise and discreditation operations are a tried-and-true method used in America, too. For example, CIA officer Howard Hunt forged State Department documents showing that President John Kennedy ordered the assassination of Ngo Dinh Diem. And the FBI discredited, through the use of forged documents, Martin Luther King, Daniel Ellsberg, and Gene Seberg, among others. When genuine, however, captured documents provide valuable insights into the enemy's plans and strategies. Indeed, said Jack from the Vietnam Task Force, Colby proved Phoenix's effectiveness through captured documents. For example, in its 1970 end-of-year report, the Phoenix Directorate quoted captured documents signed by the Deputy Secretary of COSVN as saying that Phoenix and the Accelerated Pacification Campaign were the most dangerous and effective measures used by the GVN against the insurgency. Another captured document quoted in the report stated that Personnel of the Fenghuang Intelligence Organization are the most dangerous enemies of the revolution in suburban and rural areas. Judging by information from captured documents, interrogations of captured personnel, and Hoi Chang debriefings, the directorate concluded that Fenghuang is an effective program. Captured documents, when genuine, also serve as something of a double-edged sword, revealing U.S. plans and strategies, including those pertaining to Phoenix that might otherwise remain secret. Consider, for example, a circular titled On the Establishment of the Enemy Fenghuang Intelligence Organization in Villages, issued by the Viet Cong Security Service in Region 6 on March 29, 1970, captured on May 15, 1970, and cited as document 05-3344-70 by the Combined Document Exploitation Center, CDEC, it describes how the VCI viewed and planned to combat Phoenix. As stated in the circular, the most wicked maneuvers of Phoenix have been to seek out every means by which to terrorize revolutionary families and force the people to disclose the location of our agents and join the People's Self-Defense Force. They also spread false rumors and make love with our cadres' wives and daughters. Their main purpose is to jeopardize the prestige of the revolutionary families, create dissension between them and the people, and destroy the people's confidence in the revolution. In addition, they also try to bribe poor and miserable revolutionary families into working for them. Phoenix agents are described as village or hamlet administrative personnel, policemen and landowners who set up the People's Intelligence Organization and work with pacification personnel and intelligence agents to organize family cadre, issue ID cards, and classify the people. Phoenix agents were said to have made a list of the cadre to be eliminated when the ceasefire took place. Their prescribed criteria are to kill 5 cadre in each village in order to change the balance between enemy and friendly forces in the village. According to the circular, the primary task of GVN village chiefs is to assign Phoenix Intelligence Organization and security assistance to develop and take charge of the PSDF and select a number of tyrants in this force to activate invisible armed teams, which are composed of 3 to 6 well-trained members each. These teams are to assassinate our key cadre, as in Vinglong Province. What the circular is describing is the culmination of Ralph Johnson's contra-coup process, in which counter-terrorists were extracted from People's Self-Defense Forces by Bung Tao-trained village chiefs under the aegis of the Fenghuang program. By 1970, political warfare was also being managed through Phoenix. The 1970 end-of-year report cites an experimental program in which armed propaganda teams of 7 men were placed under the operational control of the DIOCCs. On a day-to-day basis, the DIOCC provided targeted information on specific VCI or VCI families to the APT, which would then contact them in an effort to induce them to rally. Ralliers were interrogated immediately, thereby achieving a snowball effect in the targeting subsequent neutralization process. Defectors were dubbed Phoenix returnees. By 1970, Phoenix was also sponsoring indoctrination courses. In May, Fenghuang agents in Bien Ban District organized the People's Training Course to denounce communist crimes. This training course, its name evoking memories of Diem's denunciation campaign, was attended by 280 local residents. The problem was that contra-coup had no corresponding ideology. Ralph Johnson could turn the enemy's tactics against him, but not his beliefs. On this point, the captured circular reads, "As a result of the victories of the revolution, the enemy has been forced to accept serious failures and to de-escalate the war. In the face of the situation, the U.S. imperialists have been forced into withdrawing their troops. This fact has caused great confusion and dissension within the enemy ranks. The people have developed great hatred for the enemy. In addition, there is dissension among the Phoenix intelligence members, pacification personnel, policemen, and espionage agents due to internal conflict." Fanning this dissension was the ability of the VCI to penetrate IOCCs. A captured Viet Cong document, dated July 1, 1970, and issued by the Dien Bien District Security Office, Ang Ning, instructs its agents to penetrate all Fenghuang Hang Quang Intelligence Operations Coordination Centers to establish blacklists of personnel, especially Special Branch and PSDF, and to report on their activities for elimination. Da Nang City and Quang Nam Province were particularly well penetrated. A Combined Document Exploitation Center CDEC report dated November 23, 1970 cites three messages pertaining to Phoenix and the PSDF committee in Da Nang City and the location and activities of the GVN Intelligence Service in Da Nang City. A blank release slip from the Dien Bien DIOCC, copied by an unidentified individual, and an undated note regarding a Fung Huang meeting at the Kwangnam PIOCC at Hoi An. According to another captured document provided by the Combined Document Exploitation Center on October 21, 1970, a member of the Da Nang Military Interrogation Center escaped after the MSS had discovered he was a double agent. Still another captured document notes that an agent of the Fung Huang organization in the 2nd Precinct, Da Nang City, who was the son of the secretary of the VNQDD, Vietnamese Kuomintang, at Vinh Phuc Village, provided detailed information on a Fung Huang training course he attended on 15 June 1970 and the assignment of the trainees upon completion of the course, meaning the VCI in Da Nang knew every move Phoenix was making. Nelson Brigham viewed Vietnam as a war that would be won or lost on the basis of intelligence, and he created Phoenix as the vanguard in that battle. Unfortunately, the Phoenix front line unraveled faster than the VCI's. Dissension between the Americans and Vietnamese and the CIA and the military doomed the program to failure. And while the insurgents held tight, mistrust of U.S. government policy in Southeast Asia, born during Tet 1968 and brought to a boil by the Cambodian invasion, began to unravel American society. Immediately following the Cambodian invasion, massive anti-war demonstrations erupted across the country. In Ohio, Governor James Rhodes reacted violently, vowing to eradicate the protesters. On May 4, 1970, the Ohio National Guard responded to his exhortations, firing into a crowd of demonstrators at Kent State College, killing four people. The spectacle of American soldiers killing American citizens had a chilling effect on many people, many of whom suddenly realized that dissent was as dangerous in the United States as it was in South Vietnam. To many Americans, the underlying tragedy of the Vietnam War, symbolized by Phoenix, was finally felt at home. Nixon himself articulated those murderous impulses when he told his staff, "Don't worry about decisiveness. Having drawn the sword, stick it in hard. Hit him in the gut. No defensiveness." Nixon backed his words with actions. He ordered one of his aides, a former Army intelligence specialist and president of the Young Americans for Freedom, Tom Houston, to devise a plan to surveil, compromise, and discredit his domestic critics. The Houston plan was called evidence of a Gestapo mentality by Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina. What Ervin meant by the Gestapo mentality was Phoenix in its conceptual sense, the use of terror to stifle dissent. Reflecting Nixon's Gestapo mentality, offensive counterintelligence operations were directed against dissenters in America, blacks, leftists, pacifists, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, and American Indians. The most famous example may have been mounted by the CIA's domestic operations branch against the Black Liberation Movement, as in Chile, it provoked a violent reaction by security forces and served to justify repression. Colston Westbrook, according to May Brussell in a July 1974 article in The Realist, was a CIA Psy War expert. An advisor to the Korean CIA and Lon Nol in Cambodia, Westbrook, from 1966 until 1969, reportedly worked, undercover as an employee of Pacific Architects and Engineers, as an advisor to the Vietnamese Police Special Branch. In 1970, Westbrook allegedly returned to the United States and was gotten a job at the University of California at Berkeley. According to Brussell, Westbrook's control officer was William Herman, who was connected to the Stanford Research Institute, Rand Corporation, and Hoover Center on Violence. In his capacity as an advisor to Governor Ronald Reagan, Herman put together a pacification plan for California at the UCLA Center for Study and Prevention of Violence. As part of this pacification plan, Westbrook, a black man, was assigned the task of forming a black cultural association at the Vacaville Medical Facility. Although ostensibly fostering black pride, Westbrook was in truth conducting an experimental behavior modification program. Westbrook's job, claims Brussell, was to program unstable persons, drawn from California prisons, to assassinate black community leaders. His most successful client was Donald DeFries, chief of the Symbionese Liberation Army, SLA. It was Westbrook who designed the SLA's logo, a seven-headed cobra, who gave DeFreeze his African name, Cinque, and who set Cinque and his gang on their Phoenix flight to cremation, care of the Los Angeles SWAT team, the FBI, and U.S. Treasury agents. In 1971, Nixon was to direct his domestic affairs officer, John Ehrlichman, to form a special White House internal security unit called the Plumbers. Chosen to head the Plumbers were certified psychopath Gordon Liddy and false document preparation expert Howard Hunt. In charge of controls was Edgell Crow, who once said, "Anyone who opposes us will destroy. As a matter of fact, anyone who doesn't support us will destroy." Just as Tew's domestic political opponents were targets on Phoenix blacklists in Vietnam, so the Plumbers' enemies list included critics of Nixon, people like Gregory Peck, Joe Namath, and Stanley Karno. And just as illegal methods were used to discredit and compromise neutralists in Vietnam, so too the Plumbers turned to crime in their attack against anyone who doesn't support us. Along with Hunt and several other government officials, Crow, a devout Mormon, was to be convicted of breaking into the home of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Offensive counterintelligence operations directed against the anti-war movement were mounted by the Plumbers, the CIA through its Operation Chaos, the FBI through its COINTELPROs under William C. Sullivan, whose favorite trick was issuing Kafkaesque secret subpoenas, the National Security Agency, which used satellites to spy on dissenters, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, servicing the Joint Chiefs and working with the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence, General William Yarborough, through Operation Shamrock, headquartered at Fort Holabird. Shamrock's main targets were former military intelligence personnel like Ed Murphy and special operations veterans like Elton Manzioni, both of whom by then were members of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Allegedly, as part of Shamrock, the 111th Military Intelligence Group, MIG, in Memphis, kept Martin Luther King Jr. under 24-hour-a-day surveillance and reportedly watched and took photos while King's assassin moved into position, took aim, fired, and walked away. As a result, some VVAW members contend that the murders of King and other less notable victims were the work of a domestic variety Phoenix hit team. Some say it still exists. Be that as it may, it is a fact that during the Vietnam War, the government sought to neutralize its domestic opponents using illegal means in the name of national security. The fear of surveillance being as effective as surveillance itself, the result was that many Americans refrained from writing letters to their representatives or otherwise participating in the democratic process, knowing that to do so was to risk wiretaps on their phones, FBI agents reading their mail, being blackmailed for past indiscretions, made victims of vicious rumor campaigns, losing their jobs, or worse. Moreover, the suppression of dissent in America was championed by the same people who advocated war in Vietnam. And when it became apparent that America had been defeated in Vietnam, these reactionaries, like the Germans after World War I, vented their bitterness and anger on the disparate groups that formed the anti-war movement. Using Phoenix's offensive counterintelligence tactics, the security forces in America splintered the anti-war movement into single-issue groups, which were isolated and suppressed during the backlash of the Reagan era. Today, the threat of terrorism alone remains pounded into the national consciousness at the bequest of big business by abiding media. Indeed, without the complicity of the media, the government could not have implemented Phoenix in either Vietnam or America. A full disclosure of the province interrogation centers and the provincial reconnaissance units would have resulted in its demise. But the relationship between the media and the government is symbiotic, not adversarial. The extent to which the practice existed was revealed in 1975 when William Colby informed a congressional committee that more than 500 CIA officers were operating undercover as corporate executives and that 40 CIA officers were posing as journalists. Case in point, reactionary columnist and TV talk show host William Buckley Jr., the millionaire creator of the Young Americans for Freedom and cohort of Howard Hunt's in Mexico in the 1950s. When it comes to the CIA and the press, one hand washes the other. In order to have access to informed officials, reporters frequently suppress or distort stories. In return, officials leak stories to reporters to whom they owe favors. At its most incestuous, reporters and government officials are actually related. For example, Delta PRU Commander Charles LeMoyne and his New York Times reporter brother, James. Likewise, if Ed Lansdale had not had Joseph Alsop to print his black propaganda in the United States, there probably would have been no Vietnam War. In a democratic society, the media ought to investigate and report objectively on the government, which is under no obligation to inform the public of its activities and which, when it does, puts a positive spin on the news. As part of the deal, when those activities are conducted in secret, illegally, reporters tend to look away rather than jeopardize profitable relationships. The price of success is compromise of principles. This is invariably the case. The public is always the last to know. And what it does learn are at best half-truths squeezed into 500-word columns or 30-second TV bites, themselves easily ignored or forgotten. So it was with Phoenix.